crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel, this Sunday, October 14th. Thank you very much for joining us. For the past 7 years, we have repeatedly drawn your attention to an article entitled How the Syrian Crisis Will End. And in that piece, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, boldly proclaimed that this war would result in a really substantial change. He said that a German-led Europe will replace Iran as being the dominant outside force inside Syria. A bold prediction right at the beginning, and even still now. But now, as this Syrian civil war looks to be concluding, a path towards the fulfillment of this forecast is becoming clear. And I'm going to talk about why that's so in the second half of today's program. Before I get to that, though, I do want to talk about the discovery that was made this week on the outskirts of Jerusalem, or just as you enter the modern city of Jerusalem. This was a beautifully carved stone pillar, and it was found during a salvage excavation. So an excavation that's taking place before something is constructed, basically. And this was the construction right near the Jerusalem International Convention Center. This is if you've come into Jerusalem lately, you know that the way into the city has been changed. The traffic situation has changed because of this work. Well, in an excavation that is taking place there, there was uncovered this pillar made of stone, obviously, with some graffiti on it. Well, at least that's what the everyday worker thought it was, and he ran to the supervisor. And the supervisor came out there and read this ancient inscription that was written on this column and was completely blown away by it. The 80-centimeter-high column dated to 1000 BCE, so we're talking about 2100 years ago, and on it was a mixture of Aramaic and Hebrew letters. Though it is classed as an Aramaic inscription, the Hebrew part on there spelt nothing other than Jerusalem. Now, what's interesting about this, not the fact that necessarily it has Jerusalem written on it, even though we're in Jerusalem, and that it's from 2000 years ago, was the fact that it was, the way that it was spelt included the original Hebrew spelling of Jerusalem. Now, later on, instead of having the Yud in Jerusalem, that Yud is dropped eventually, but this ancient way of writing it did have the Yud in it. So it's quite interesting. This is the oldest surviving inscription with this correct Hebrew spelling of the word Jerusalem on it. And so if you're excited about that, as I'm sure you are, you can go ahead and go to Watch Jerusalem and read an article by Christopher Eames. It's entitled The Jerusalem Stone, the Newly Discovered Exceptionally Rare Inscription of an Exceptionally Common Name. And he fills in on the backstory of this and how that it was written during the time of the Hasmoneans or the Maccabeans. And there was another stunning discovery as well that came out this week, referring to a pretty large, kind of like a mass grave, I would say, from John Hyrcanus's time. Oh, Alexander Junius, sorry, John Hyrcanus's son, one of the Maccabean rulers who was quite a divisive figure between the Sadducees and the Pharisees at the time, and ended up killing quite a lot of people. That's what the Maccabees talk about, and also Josephus writes about that. And there have been numerous bodies that have been found as well, been put to death, beheaded, it looks, in this close to this area. And so a couple of findings from the Hasmonean period were made this week. But this article, The Jerusalem Stone, you can go ahead to go to watchjerusalem.co.il and read up about it. Again, it's from Christopher Eames. A couple of bits of feedback now before we get to the main subject that I want to talk about came in this week. Just one simple one. This is related to the program from last week. And this is from somebody in Texas saying, fascinating show. Every time Mr. Brent and Mr. Chris team up, they knock it out of the park. And so I thank you for that. There's always room for improvement, specifically with all of our R's and ums as we give these programs. But we are trying to ensure that we give you quality substance on these programs, be it about archaeology or Middle Eastern news and how that fits in Bible prophecy. These are two, or the tandem mission really of Watch Jerusalem is to fill you in on how world events from this region are fulfilling Bible prophecy and why that's significant. Then also showing you just the rapidity of archaeological discoveries that are being unearthed in this country and around the world in this region that really support the historical narrative of the Bible. And so we try and give you the most up-to-date findings related to archaeology as well. Just another one that came in. This is from actually one of the authors, Christopher Eames. He wrote this piece about language being a cultural universal. We talked about it on last week's program, but somebody responded to sent a letter in or an email in to letters at watchjerusalem.co.il. And there's somebody here that lives right here in Jerusalem in the German colony, close to where I live. And it was the author of one of the books that Chris referred to. The author's name is Isaac Mosen. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Anyhow, he wrote on the Edenics part that Mr. Christopher Eames talked about in that article. And so he just expressed his appreciation for the well-written article, as he called it. And then he said, up until this point, I had not known about Watch Jerusalem. Now all of my readers know too. I'm most impressed that your focus is on biblical prophecy fulfillment and not dogma issues about the more correct Messiah identification. And so he's appreciative of the fact that we're just putting out the prophecy as it's there. That's what we're interested in as far as that side of it goes. We're interested in showing you how the events taking place in the Middle East, and you'll see that on the second half today's show, very much do fulfill Bible prophecy, and it all leads to the coming of the Messiah. Soon, as these prophecies, the ones we'll talk about today are important because in the same group of scriptures that these are mentioned in, these prophecies, it's part of a chronology. A chronology that leads right to the coming of the Messiah. That's the end result of these prophecies. And we are going to talk about that related to the Syrian civil war next. So please don't go away.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening.
In the middle of 2015, Iran was in a precarious situation inside Syria. Up to that point, we were 4 years into the civil war already, and Tehran had basically ensured the survival of the Syrian regime and President Bashar al-Assad by themselves. No one else was really in there supporting the President Assad. It had ordered thousands of its Hezbollah fighters from southern Lebanon to cross the mountains there, come in support of the Syrian dictator. It sent Shiite mercenaries from Afghanistan, Pakistan, by the tens of thousands across into Syria from the east. And then a massive conscription effort of Syrian men was funded in part, at least by Iranian cash. Now, through all this support, it seemed like Assad and Syria would have to be forever wedded to Iran, for saving them out of this situation. Nevertheless, with all of that support back in up to 2015, the Assad regime continued to lose territory. The rise of the Islamic State in the southeast, along the border with Iraq, the dominance of the American-backed Kurds as well in the northeast, and then also the Syrian rebels themselves were fighting hard. They were really holed up in areas of the north and west, and also parts around Damascus as well. And this meant that in the middle of 2015, Assad only controlled about 25% of the land inside Syria. And that's why at the time we wrote, is this the end of Assad? Is he going to lose this war? And we weren't the only ones writing that, just because of looking at the massive amount of territory that he lost and the tiny bit of territory that he controlled. So while this was going on in 2015, you knew that things were bad when we saw Qassem Soleimani show up on the Syrian battlefield. He's the leader of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force. This is Iran's expeditionary force, which goes into different countries and kind of motivates, trains, proxies, basically, to ensure that they are fighting according to the lines of the Iranians and they get the necessary training and equipment to do that. And he was spotted inside Syria. Now, the next thing that happened at that point, which was very interesting, is that he didn't return to Iran, or if he did, it was only briefly, because he was seen or reported to have gone to Russia shortly thereafter. Now, in reporting of that fateful Moscow meeting, Soleimani was said to have laid a map of Syria on the table before Russian President Vladimir Putin and explained the need for Russian air power in order to preserve not only Iran's holdings in Syria, but also Russia's. Russia is obviously a long-time ally of the Syrian regime, even predating the Iranian support that really picked up after the Iranian Revolution, Islamic Revolution in 1979 in Iran. Russia was there before. Russia was there soon after the Second World War, supporting Assad's father. And so they obviously wanted to ensure that Assad, or at least the Syrian regime, continued, so that their naval base, their only Mediterranean naval base on the port on the Mediterranean there, could survive. And so it seems that, obviously by the fruits, that in this meeting with Soleimani, he was quite convincing, and that Putin decided that it was going to be a good idea. I mean, he was eager, as he had said so, to restore Russia to its former Soviet prominence, and he relished the opportunity to return to the Middle East with largely minimal cost. And it hasn't cost Russia a substantial amount of money to be there. Obviously, it's cost much more than they thought it was going to be, because I think they're still there, and they're there longer than what they thought they were going to be. Nevertheless, months later, after this meeting with Soleimani, Russia was there on the ground. Russian started with a few loose reports saying that men that kind of spoke Russian, not in Russian uniform, were there, just the same way they always do it, as we saw them do it in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. They were doing the same thing in Syria. And before long, I think it was October or November, we had Russian jets in the sky and Vladimir Putin saying that he's there to take out the Islamic State, which, if you look at where they hit with their missiles and with their ammunitions from their planes, it wasn't really going after the Islamic State that much, but it was preserving the Syrian regime from the rebels. Now, this decision by Iran to invite Russia to join the fight to preserve the Syrian regime was an extreme risk, and it is evidence of how close the Syrian regime was to collapsing. The fact that Iran asked Russia's help so late in the game indicates that they would have rather done it alone. Now, why inviting Russia to assist them was such a risk for Iran is only now coming full into view as the Syrian war draws to a close. The rebels right now, they're confined to certain parts of Idlib province in the north and west. The Islamic State is largely vanquished. At least it's not a threat to the Syrian regime at all. And then the Kurds, the Assad's quite happy to let them go for now until a future mission, I suppose. But the future of the Assad regime, at least the Syrian regime with Assad at the helm, is largely secured. And now it's the time for Assad to repay his benefactors for their service at preserving his rule. But instead of just having Iran to reward, as that would have been the case if Iran was successful at holding up and propping up Assad without the Russians, they're going to have to satisfy the Russians at the same time. And this is something that is looking increasingly unrealistic given the incompatibility of the post-war goals for Moscow and Tehran. This was always going to be the case, and the reason why Iran did not want to go to Russia, because if they were successful, and they have been, with Russia providing the air power and Iran providing the ground forces, if they are successful at preserving the Syrian regime, how are they both going to be rewarded? Are they going to be able to get along in the future Syrian state? And it seems that there's been plenty of reporting to show that they can't get along. And Iran is worried. Iran is worried that the Syrian regime is going to side with Russia in the future rather than Tehran. A lot of this comes from the drive of both of these parties to benefit from the reconstruction of Syria. This is something that Russia needs financially. The estimates right now, after 8 years, almost 8 years of civil war, is that repairing Syria is going to cost close to $400 billion. That's a lot of money. And Iran and Russia, they want to be the beneficiaries of that reconstruction money by having Russian or Iranian companies being awarded the business contracts by the Assad regime. Now, right now, they are, you know, kind of doling out these contracts for the exploration of Syria's oil fields, control of the massive phosphate mines looks like it might go to Iran, electrical plant construction or reconstruction looks like it might go to the Russians. Then Iran's trying to get the future control of Syria's telecom industry. Both of these countries are going to the Syrian regime saying, we want this, we want this, we want this. Now, what's interesting by this is obviously both these countries, Russia and Iran, the people that Syria needs to pay off for the work that they've done, both of these countries don't have the money to build these things themselves. They don't just want the future contracts, they want the money now to build and reconstruct Syria. And so they're going to have to get this money from elsewhere to fund the reconstruction of Syria. But what nation or group of nations is going to foot the bill of Syrian reconstruction when it will be lining the pockets of the Iranians, whose continuously belligerent behavior is the major reason for the perpetuation of the Syrian civil war in the first place? And Russia is quickly finding out right now that none of that $400 billion was going to come their way, not while they're partnering with the Iranians. Because the Iranians don't necessarily want an end to war in Syria. They don't want that. They might want the end of the Syrian civil war, but they're quite happy to use Syria now as a forward platform to increase its pressure on the Jewish state, to fully fund and equip Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, to leave the Shiite militias that are there in Syria, not retreat, not get out of Syria once the regime is preserved, but use the Syrian civil war as an excuse for their own objectives. And if that's the case, then Russia isn't going to see a cent of that money. And you'll see what I mean. Now, we have been watching Iran's rise to dominance in the Middle East for 20 plus years. It's clear that Iran is a hegemonic power, has ambitions to rule the region and beyond. And Iran's Syria policy and its support for the Assad regime should be seen in that light. Now, a critical facet of this strategy of Iran involving Syria is what is known as the Shia Crescent. You might have heard about this before. This is a vast swath of land that arches from Iran in the east, heads west through Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, onto the Mediterranean coast. And through this area, there is a substantial population of the followers of Shia Islam, of which Iran dominates. All the other Muslim countries are majority Sunni, apart from Azerbaijan, I believe, and Bahrain. And so with 80 million people and almost all of those followers of Shia Islam, we have Iran, the Ayatollah in Iran, dominating that religion. Now, Iran needs to control this territory in order to project its power into the Mediterranean Sea and also to threaten Israel on its northeastern borders. And so this means in order to control this landmass from Iran to the ocean, the Islamic regime needs allies in these three states. Now, in Lebanon, it's long had an ally, obviously, through the use of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, to the point that in the mid-2000s, Hezbollah made it into the Lebanese parliament and is basically holding that government to ransom often, all the time. And so Iran effectively is in control of a lot that Lebanon does or doesn't do. Then in Iraq, we've talked a lot on this program about how the vanquishing of the Islamic State over the past 2 years by Shiite militias loyal to Iran. These pro-Iranian elements that exist inside the Iraqi government have been able to thrive as that Shiite militia then joins the government, as we've seen right now. It's part of that government. And then we also see numerous Western Iraqi border crossings that are controlled by Shiite elements inside the Iraqi military. And this kind of shows that Iraq, although you would see reporting after this latest bout of decision-making in regards to the government there, that it's more evenly based between the U.S. and Iran, that's not true. Iran is very strong inside Iraq. And so they are quite happy with the position they hold there. But nestled in between the territory of Iraq and Lebanon is Syria. In order to complete this Shia crescent, Iran needed to ensure the survival of the Syrian regime. That's why it was there. It wasn't there out of they weren't there out of love for Bashar al-Assad. Really, Bashar al-Assad, even though his faith, he belongs to the Alawites, that's an offshoot of Shia. That's not the main reason. They're there because they wanted to preserve his rule to better them. This wasn't a religious thing for them, for the Iranians. This was, let's preserve our ally who is maintaining our ability to hold this vast swath of land, the Shia crescent. And Bashar al-Assad became under threat from his majority Syrian Sunni population in the civil war, and that's why Iran did everything it could to preserve the regime. Now, what's important is Iran saw its entrance into the Syrian civil war as an opportunity to strengthen its position in Syria. It sent tens of thousands of Shiite militia that were loyal to the Ayatollah to preserve Assad, so that, or with the intent, really, to stay there and dictate Iranian policy inside Syria after the war is over. And that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing. And Assad's sitting there. And really, he's got to pretty much decide now, is he going to be a stooge of the Iranians, or is he going to follow through on what the Russians want? And, you know, if Iran had been able to do all of that, to preserve the Syrian regime by themselves without the Russians, given that they virtually control freedom of movement across Iraq if they want it, and into southern Lebanon, we would be in a far more dangerous situation right now. Iran controlling this entire stretch of land from Pakistan to the Mediterranean. But instead, Iran invited the Russians to join them and fight, and so doing complicated their plans of the Shia crescent. Now, Russia may have largely been accepting of Iranian dominance in post-war war Syria. Right now, if Iran was willing to divvy up the extremely lucrative peacetime reconstruction projects, if they were willing to just stop fighting for a while, the Iranians, so that the world powers would be willing to give their money to a cause to reconstruct Syria, then Russia might just accept that Iran's going to be there. They'll share the spoils. Russia will get the necessary funds that it needs. And it might be they might continue as allies. But since Iran's presence there is holding the nation of Syria ransom, and really holding Russia's economic windfall ransom, Russia's got some serious decisions to make. Now, the thing that really made this more difficult for the Iranians and the Russians is the fact that as Iran tries to continue to use Syria as its own military base to wage war, really, against Israel and prepare to wage war against Israel, Israel is not having it. Israel has attacked targets, military targets inside Syria more than 200 times in the past almost 2 years, since the start of 2016. They've fired over 800 missiles and mortar shells into that territory. Now, the targets are mostly weapons depots, arms convoys that Iran is using to both prop up Assad, but also to fully stock the Shiite militias under their control, including Hezbollah. And that's all there for a future war against Israel. That's what they're trying to do. But Israel has continuously pledged that it would not allow Iran to establish such a beachhead inside Syria, nor will it allow for the game-changing missiles to get to Hezbollah, and so that they can be used against Israel. And Israel, credit where credit's due, has backed up that pledge with incessant strikes against Iranian interests in Syria. So put simply, if Iran continues to be aggressive in Syria against Israel, Israel keep attacking. And this military action then threatens to continue to destabilize Syria. It perpetuates the war. And so some nations, including the United States, are conditioning any reconstruction aid money given to the Syrian regime to be used and most likely used by Russian, given to Russian companies and Iranian companies to build up the state. A lot of nations are conditioning that money on Iran's withdrawal from Syria, which that's thoroughly frustrating Russia, this whole situation. Again, Russia would have been fine with Iran, you know, taking the reins in Syria, but allowing, you know, a bit of calm to happen so that people could fund the reconstruction so Russia could be increase their financial worth, use the money, get the money that they really need. But that isn't going to happen, it seems. On October 10th, just this past week, United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, quote, if Syria doesn't ensure the total withdrawal of Iranian-backed troops, it will not receive one single dollar from the United States for reconstruction. Again, we're talking about a figure that's astronomical. $400 billion is what it's going to take to rebuild Syria. Now, that the United States is taking this position isn't necessarily unsurprising. However, it seems that European governments, especially the potential donors for this reconstruction process, are also closely following the United States' position. And they are going even further in conditioning their money on Assad's departure. The German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said in September that his country will help pay for the reconstruction if there's a political solution leading to free elections. And then Bloomberg reported this week as well that while Assad remains in power, Germany won't contribute anything. And so while that, I think this is something that could change, with the situation that Germany might donate money if there's free and fair elections, and then Assad comes back into power. They're not happy with the Iranians. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel 2 weeks ago was in Jerusalem at the King David Hotel talking with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and talked about her goal as well to get Iran out of Syria. That's her goal. Now, Putin has been on a mission of late to try and get this money. He's obviously not going to the United States for it. He doesn't think they'll get it, or they'll give it. But he does think that the Europeans would be very interested at funding Syria's reconstruction. This is how Faisal Al-Yafai wrote in The National on August 21st. He says this, quote, "This is the central argument of Putin's new strategy, that without money to rebuild Syria, millions of refugees cannot go home, those the refugees that are in Europe right now. It is a message he knows will be heard attentively in the Middle Eastern and European countries that have borne the brunt of the refugee crisis." And so he's going up and talking to Merkel, and you remember them meeting together and sipping on a glass of wine. I think it might have been somewhere it was somewhere in Germany, I think, or Austria. And they were talking about Syria, and that's basically what he said. "You don't like these migrants? You see what they're doing to your country, how they're tearing apart your country, at least the post-World War II norms of Europe and Germany with a million migrants there? Well, let's fix Syria. I'm happy to fix Syria. My companies are ready to go. All we need is the money." And the German leader is saying, "We're not giving you a cent. We're not giving you a cent. Not while there is still a civil war raging, not while the Iranians are still attacking the Israelis." They didn't say that in as many words, but that's what's implied. And so no one, it seems, is going to be willing to put forward money to fund the reconstruction with Iran continuing to pursue its own offensive strategy against Israel. And so there have been indications now that Russia and Syria might try to move forward and sideline Iran. Now, this is going to be a hard ask. I'm not saying that this is easy to do. They've got tens of thousands of soldiers inside the country right now. And to remove Assad from the power of Iran, that would be very difficult to do. But Syria is really going to have to choose right now between being an Iranian stooge under the diktats or acting under the diktats of a clerical regime in Iran and therefore being like welded to the hip to Iran from here on out, or they might choose now to cut and run, side with the rest of the world, as it's seeming. Yes, the rest of the world is very upset with Russia, but they would be willing to let Russia oversee the reconstruction there inside Syria. They would, if it meant the Iranians were gone. Now, unlike many of the other nations under Tehran's sway, the religious sway, the Alawites do not really follow the same fanatical ideas and could be induced to change their allegiances. Already, there are some Iranian MPs that are worried that such a move is taking place. There is this Iranian MP, Behroz Bonyadi. He said this. This was earlier this year. Bashar al-Assad, full impotence, has cozied up to Putin. Russia will not be a trustworthy friend for us. And then he talked about how Russia is even being a stooge of the United States. That's probably not the case. But nevertheless, they see it. The Iranians see the potential for Syria to side with Russia. Now, while it is difficult, again, to see how the Iranians will leave Syria, given how entrenched they are in the nation right now, there are plenty of reasons to see why Moscow will be compelled to help that along, and how if they are pressured without getting this money from anyone else, if they are pressured to do so, they will try. And they've already tried. They've already tried and said, we'll remove them this far from the Israeli border. Israel comes back and says, no, not good enough. The Americans come back and say, no, not good enough. They need to be out. And so there's every reason to believe that they will attempt to remove them. And if people put forth their money, the Americans or the Europeans put forth a lot of money towards this, they're going to want some guarantees. They're going to want some guarantees, maybe with their own men on the ground, to ensure that the Iranians do not come back or that they leave. Now, while given the reasons I've cited, it does look like that Iran is going to be pressured to be removed from Syria, there is a far more important reason of why this is going to happen, and the whole reason that we're covering it today. And that is because Bible prophecy indicates that Iran will be removed from power inside Syria. And Bible prophecy is a far more reliable testament or proof of this happening than anything I've cited above. And what I love about this prophecy is that we have been saying it for so long and we've held true to it regardless of what it looks like, regardless of what the facts on the ground look like. And so when it happens, it is going to be a pretty big testament to the accuracy of the Bible. Now, as I said, it might sound astounding, and I understand that it sounds astounding, that the Bible, a book written by multiple authors, inspired by God thousands of years ago, would have prophecies that relate to the Syrian civil war right now. I understand that that might sound a bit outlandish, but we can see how accurate it is by looking at two biblical prophecies right now and how they relate to Iran's strategy in the Middle East. Now, the first of these prophecies is known, first of these alliances in the Middle Eastern alliances is known in the Bible, and we've talked about it as the King of the South. This is terminology that's found in the book of Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. It talks about this King of the South. We have a booklet about this written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, entitled King of the South. It goes through both of these alliances that I'll talk about in the next couple minutes before we end. But the first one of these is known as the King of the South. And for 25 years, we've shown readers that and listeners that this King of the South is Iran as it leads radical political Islam. Now, when this alliance is fully achieved, this pro-Iranian alliance will include Iraq, as well as some nations along the western coastline of the Red Sea and the southern Mediterranean. They'll include Egypt, Ethiopia, Eritrea there, and even Libya. Now, one nation not included in this alliance, as the Bible says, is this nation of Syria. Instead, Syria is part of the other Middle Eastern alliance, end-time Middle Eastern alliance, which is talked about in Psalm chapter 83. Now, the Psalms, a lot of the time, they're not prophecy, but some of the times they are. And verse 4 states, talks about this prophecy of this alliance that's being built right now in the Middle East, and it's almost entirely there, but for, Syria and Lebanon. They're the two nations that aren't part of this already. The rest of these nations all together. Verse 4 states this, It says, they have consulted together with one consent. They are a confederate against you. And these are the ancient peoples that are part of it. Obviously, they're modern types. It mentions the tabernacles of Edom, the Ishmaelites of Moab, and the Hagarenes, Gebal, and Ammon, and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher is also joined with them, it says. And so, as any Bible commentary will tell you, this alliance has never happened before in history. This isn't history, this psalm. If you believe the Bible is accurate, you'll have to believe that this is an alliance that is yet to happen. And it's obvious an alliance that takes place before the Messiah comes. And so we're looking at the time right now. And one of those nations that is mentioned in the alliance there is these people called the Hagarenes. Now, I'm not going to take a long time to discuss who the Hagarenes were. We are producing an article on this subject, which will give you a lot of the proofs to show that the Hagarenes are the nation, or most of the nation of Syria, especially the parts of Syria around Damascus. The Bible talks about the Hagarenes and other parts being at war with Saul's kingdom for a time. It talks about exactly where they were located. And so the Hagarenes are modern-day Syria. Now, this alliance that they're a part of, the Psalm 83 alliance, we'll call it, it also has a nation that's outside the Middle East as a part of it, and that nation is Germany. Now, Russia isn't mentioned in it at all, but Germany is. And so we won't really talk about necessarily how that could play into this too much, but we do see the German elements there, as certainly as Russia goes after them to fund this program, how they could be introduced to the Syrian territory, or introduced to the Syrian problem before long. Now, in many ways, this Psalm 83 alliance is an anti-Iranian alliance. The nations that are in the King of the South are not mentioned inside this alliance of Psalm 83. Not one's doubled. Obviously, they are two alliances that are on opposite ends of the spectrum. And based on the understanding of these two end-time alliances, we have forecast that Syria's alliance for Iran is destined to end. That's how we can make that claim. If one alliance in the Bible, pro-Iranian. The other alliance is not pro-Iranian. And Syria belongs to the other alliance. And so we knew it was going to happen. And so we can say in full confidence that Syria, in the end, is going to be removed from the Iranian orbit. What's interesting about these prophecies or these alliances is that Lebanon also is going to be part of this Psalm 83 alliance, and it isn't right now. It's pro-Iranian right now. And so it looks, if we just speculate on this, it looks like Iran losing out in Syria is also going to affect Iran's control of Lebanon. It's also going to affect Iran's access to the Mediterranean Sea, one of these goals of the Shia Crescent. They're going to lose out on their goal for control of this great swath of land. And if you look at the other prophecies in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, referring to the king of the south and the nations that are going to be allied with Iran, notice where they exist. They exist, if you look at Egypt, if you look at Eritrea and Ethiopia, if you look at Libya, they're the ones that are specifically mentioned there in Daniel 11 as being allied with the king of the south. They're all along this Red Sea passageway going up through the Suez Canal into the southern Mediterranean. And so it seems, and right now, if you look at Eritrea, Ethiopia, Libya, if you look at Egypt, Iran is not in control of those nations. They're not allied with Iran. That is going to happen, though. And is it the case? I'm just speculating here, but is it the case that after Iran loses out in Syria, recognizing the fact that its policy of getting to the Eastern Mediterranean through Syria and Lebanon has failed, that they're going to put more attention to another route to get control of the Mediterranean? And are they going to push forward through the Red Sea? We already see their strategy by arming the Houthis there and sending missiles across to target shipping, be those Saudi oil tankers or not, or other ships. They've already got this policy, but maybe it'll get it added impetus when they lose out in Syria. And this is just some ways we can look in the Bible and see these alliances and then look at the world today and see how plausible they are, how logical they are that that'll take place. Now, we don't rely on the plausibility of these prophecies being our belief in their accuracy. The Bible says it, and so it's so. It is. But it's just, it's amazing and wonderful to see how clearly they can come to pass and how conditions are being set up for their fulfillment right now. Now, right at the outset of the Syrian civil war, again, our editor-in-chief wrote this article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. And he said this, very interesting comment in it. He said, what we're seeing right now in Syria is a major biblical prophecy in the process of being fulfilled. And again, he was talking about how Syria's alliance is going to be changed, that Syria is going to lose, or that Iran is going to lose Syria as an ally, and that German-led Europe is going to move in there. And that's being fulfilled. But then he said this, what happens in Syria, what happens in this Syrian civil war will lead to mighty nations changing course and the foundations of this world being shaken. Now, surely we have seen part of this already. Again, this is before the migrant crisis. This was written back in 2012, just when it was the Syrian civil war wasn't a civil war. It was a crisis. And that's what was said. We're going to see mighty nations changing course because of what happens in Syria. Now, the Syrian civil war has led to the largest mass migration of outsiders into Europe in human history. And in turn, this has reshaped modern Europe. It's caused it to retract from its policy of multiculturalism to nationalism, leading it out of a period of post-war stability to a climate where strongmen are being elected everywhere in Europe and elsewhere to preserve nations. Now, all those things are prophesied in their Bible. Now, we can see the effects of the Syrian civil war changing the course of other nations. It's the main motivation for the policies in Germany changing, the rise of the AfD, the rise of Austrian strongman as well, the rise of Viktor Orban, leaders that wouldn't have been elected had the migrant crisis, which largely stemmed from Syria, hadn't happened. Has what happened, what's been happening in Syria, led to mighty nations changing course? It sure has. But the changes have not finished at all. There's still some mighty changes to take place regarding Syria itself. And then also, this development to watch for when Syria falls out of the Iranian orbit, where Iran leads its attention, or gives its attention, it's going to start fulfilling Daniel 11 and verse 40 to 43 in making sure that they have the alliances of Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Libya in its back pocket. Now, what's interesting through all this and what's critical through all of this is that this development in Daniel chapter 11 and Psalm 83, it's a critical signpost of where we are in biblical prophecy. As the next few verses in Daniel relate, and also the corresponding chapter in Daniel chapter 8 relate, all of these alliances and this alliance of the King of the South forming, it leads directly to the final coming of the Messiah. Finally, then we won't have to discuss this anymore. We're not going to be discussing the almost 500,000 people that have died in Syria. It'll be done. Wars against nation on nation, alliances of convenience, they will be done. They will be over. And the Syrian civil war, while it looks like an absolute mess and it's so hard to follow, the Bible puts it in perspective. It makes it understandable. And what's most important is it shows that all this suffering, not just in Syria, but all over the world as well, all this suffering is about over. Now, if you want to understand more, again, about this prophecy regarding Syria and regarding the King of the South and how these end time events do play out, you can request that booklet I referred to several times, The King of the South, by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry. Thank you very much for listening to the program today. If you'd like to send me some feedback, you can do that by emailing your responses to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks again for listening.